Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. There have been 74 gun incidences in schools, colleges, and universities since the mass shooting at Sandy Hook Elementary in 2012. Debates over whether similar crimes could be prevented by arming teachers, by restricting access to high-capacity weapons, or improving the nation's capacity to treat mental illness blared for a few weeks, yet did nothing to prevent more assaults, accidents, and suicides. Or in the case of another troubled young man at UC Santa Barbara last spring, a killing spree. What if there were another way to intercept criminals before they struck? Predictive policing, like the pre-crime unit envisioned by Philip K. Dick in the short story Minority Report, which became a 2002 film.
I'm placing you under arrest for the future murder of Sarah Marks and Donald Dubin. That must take place today, April 22nd, at 0800 hours and 4 minutes. Give the man a sound.
Henrik Karelyzhin covered Sandy Hook as a reporter for the New York Daily News. In an article for Eon, Henrik reported on predictive policing tactics in various stages of development across the country. And Henrik Karelyzhin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me.
So you write about law enforcement in cities, towns, institutions across the U.S. using these predictive policing tactics. How far along are they in these methods?
Well, like I reported in Eon magazine, they're in varying stages across the country. Many agencies, about a dozen or so, are using what is called PredPol, which is a predictive tool that looks at where crimes occurred in order to forecast where they'll happen within the next 12-hour span. For instance, Seattle police are using it for gun violence, Atlanta police are using it for robberies, and in Pennsylvania, the police are using it for car thefts. And this isn't only in America. In the UK, Kent police are actually using it to predict drunk crimes and robberies. Hmm. But so far in America, there's three main cities that are ahead of the curve, which would be New York City, Chicago, and LA.
Talk to us about New York City, where Police Commissioner Bill Bratton is pretty much an early adopter. The NYPD has been partnering with Microsoft on what is called a domain awareness system. Now, what is this and how does it work?
Well, Bill Bratton is a huge purveyor of this predictive policing. And in New York City, what is basically set up like a war room where there are several monitors streaming from 7,000 plus cameras throughout the city. And they also have capabilities to ping cell phones if necessary. And in real time, they hear 911 calls. So if they hear a tip, if they hear an investigation, they can move forward faster than ever before in history of the NYPD.
So what is the result? Has it actually made any kind of dent in crime in New York City?
Well, with the NYPD, they tracked more than a million Facebook pages and 40,000 calls from Rikers Island and hundreds of hours of video footage. But there was a huge gang takedown, which I wrote about this June, which took down 103 Harlem gang related criminals, and that was the biggest get so far of this system. And the gangs were accused of some crimes, but what happened was they came in and made the biggest gang arrest in history of New York, and this was to prevent a war zone from erupting in the future, basically.
So it has a chilling effect on crime.
It can.
This PredPol you talked about, used in several American cities in the UK, these are monitoring areas and locales with a high probability of crime and then taking a look at the areas. But you also wrote about brain scans and DNA analysis as the next step in predictive policing, in particular, identifying genes responsible for aggression. Tell us more about this so-called warrior gene.
Well, the warrior gene essentially looks at a gene in the brain that is able to break down neurotransmitters. And some brains are able to do this better than others. And the ones that are able to do it less effectively essentially lead to more aggression. Hmm. This is what studies have showed. And it's quite fascinating when you look at it.
How conclusive is that research? And is it likely that it would ever be actually used in courts or in identifying criminals in the future?
Well, it's hard to say because there haven't been that many studies out on the actual warrior gene. There have been a few cases, a couple in 2009 that I referenced in my piece, but I feel it's unlikely that this will work in courtrooms to get people free. But I think it's certainly something to consider in the conversation of DNA testing and the future of policing.
You mentioned 2009. There was a case in Tennessee. What happened?
Well, in 2009, at a trial in Tennessee, there was a guy named Bradley Waldrop. And he was accused of killing his wife's friend by shooting her. and also slicing her head open. Mm. And then he also was accused of slicing his wife again and again with a machete, trying to kill her. But there's plenty of evidence against him, but he still avoided a first-degree murder conviction based on the fact that he had the warrior gene defense. Since he had it, he didn't have to spend life in jail.
Wow. Well, I can imagine babies being tested in the future for the warrior gene, or data kept on file of in gene banks, or people having to have brain scans during a job interview process. What do the brain scans reveal?
Well, the brain scans can reveal a lot, especially during criminal court cases. They can show violent proclivities or propensities. But in the conversation of DNA, one thing to consider is the use of DNA databases to predict crimes in the future, because they now work like fingerprinting systems, but it's not a stretch to picture law enforcement analyzing this data to discover crime trends in the future. In other words, to connect genetics to certain criminal behavior, or finding a genetic code that's connected to pedophilia, for instance.
We're speaking with Henrik Karolyzhin. He wrote about predictive policing policies and tactics that are in various stages of progress and being used by police departments and law enforcement across the country. I'm imagining, Henrik, you know, gathering, building a criminal possible profile of us based on the kind of things that we search for on the internet. I mean, how far along is this?
Well, I was actually concerned as a crime reporter that I would have my Google search come up as, for instance, say, trying to hide blood from a crime scene, which would be my research, mm-hmm. but have the FBI at my door. I'm not sure how likely that is, but that possibility being out there kind of scares me, and I'm sure it probably scares a lot of Americans.
How about the possibility of other kinds of errors? I mean, we know that DNA can be easily compromised. And in places like the Chicago Police Department, where there's entrenched gun violence, they've developed a list of people thought to be criminals in predominantly black districts. Now, this seems to me the ultimate in profiling. And I'm hearing, you know, in my head, these accusations that we heard from Ferguson, Missouri, from the protesters, that the police are expecting trouble. They are on a hair trigger.
And I think there are many concerns to come when we consider how this information is first inputted into the computers that police use. Because people who oppose these predictive crime-fighting methods say that there could be an inherent bias against certain communities and people in them. And that there is a false promise of neutrality when we rely on these crunch numbers. Because the idea is that numbers don't lie, but this is dangerous thinking because ostensibly crime is where police say it is. And they're the ones manning and controlling the place. And like you said, in Ferguson, cops can be hair trigger, and there could be issues with that.
Yeah. Brain scans also apparently problematic because they can be triggered by different kind of stimuli. Any illumination on that?
I wrote a little bit about that, but it's interesting to consider the conditions you're under when you're getting a brain scan in terms of stress and other effects. And I think it's hard to be completely objective when you're doing a brain scan just for those factors. I mean, because if you're under a lot of duress and you take a brain scan, you might have one result as opposed to if you're relaxed. And that can be problematic when you're bringing cases into courtrooms and looking at them that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, so we're seeing a shift from changing criminal behavior to prediction and prevention. What do you see? You know, you're a crime reporter. You've been looking at this kind of thing for a long time. How does this shift the way that we regard, look at, and try and ultimately police for crime?
Well, I think that this Big Brother approach is problematic. For one, it doesn't address motivation in criminal behavior. And secondly, if criminals know they're being watched like they would if they're monitored by PredPol or whatever else, they'll move. It's pretty simple. And also, more broadly, and this is a grander scope, but if you look at the structure in America that imprisons about 2 million people a year and spends roughly $80 billion in annual corrections costs, I mean, I feel like we should be focusing on studying how to prevent these crimes from happening by interacting with people and helping them instead of monitoring them and spying on them and needlessly possibly being aggressive for no reason like we saw in Ferguson.
Well, of course, the conversation after Sandy Hook was about restricting access to high-capacity weapons and, of course, about mental illness. Is there a way to flag potentially dangerous people who suffer from mental illness? Any kind of science or progress on dealing with the with the psychological terrain of somebody who might commit a murder?
Well, I think, like you said, after Newtown, which was a huge national tragedy, Obama said we need to bring mental illness out of the shadows. And I agree with that. But I also think that we need to invest in serious gun research. It would take about $10 million for the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to examine gun violence in a real way. And I think that would personally benefit many Americans because it would look at the root causes to lead these young kids to these shootings instead of arresting them after the fact. I think this would be the ultimate preventative measure you can take.
What sort of aspect of research do you think that could open up?
Well, I think if you look at, let's say, for instance, these young people who are being monitored by police in specific areas of low income and whatnot, I think if you look at these children and you try to help them and you talk to them, you can find out the real issues that are happening at the heart of the matter instead of just policing them in a normal way and monitoring them and surveilling them, because I don't think that's going to help the problem, personally.
Back to behavior. Well, Henry Karalyzhan, thank you very much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Henry Karalyzhan is a journalist and former staff writer for the Times-Picayune, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Daily News. You'll find a link to read his article on the precognitive police at wordofmouthradio.org. Fighting a crime before it happened sounds like something you just couldn't make up. How about a band of adolescent reptiles battling the baddies? The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, made in New Hampshire 30 years ago. We'll talk to one of the creators when Word of Mouth continues. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. With a Michael Bay-produced reboot now in theaters and a fresh line of merchandising to match, the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles are as big as ever. Pretty amazing when you consider that these anthropomorphized amphibians were first created in 1984, the same year that Ghostbusters came out and Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go was a hit. And while the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles may call the Big Apple their home, their origins are right here in New Hampshire. Co-creator Kevin Eastman now lives in California, but drew the very first Ninja Turtle in Dover, New Hampshire, at the home of his collaborator, Peter Laird. And Kevin Eastman joins us now for more. Kevin, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you. Thanks for having me on today.
I should clarify here that you're from Portland, Maine. But bring us back to that day when you first sketched the Ninja Turtle. Did it look much like the turtles we know today?
Oh, no, they've changed a little bit over the years. And yeah, I grew up in Portland, Maine. I used to cook lobsters in Agunquit, Maine as my summer job. And when one of the summers ended, I ended up meeting this awesome artist, Peter Laird, and moved into his house with him and his wife. And we were spending one night being particularly goofy, trying to come up with ideas that we could pitch to other comic book companies. And I did this goofy sketch of a turtle standing upright. He had a mask on and nunchucks strapped to his arms, looking very different from the way they look today. But I said, Peter, this is going to be the next big thing. Ha, ha, ha. And of course, he laughed. And studio one-upmanship, you know, he had to do a sketch that topped my sketch. And it was great. And then so I incorporated both of those into a sketch. I said, well, if not one turtle, why not four? So I did these four characters standing with different weapons, and I put this little comic book logo that said Ninja Turtles at the top, and I did my drawing in pencil. And when he inked it in, he added Teenage Mutant to it, and we were just laughing ourselves silly. We said, this literally is the dumbest idea we've ever seen.
So your jokey prediction aside, did you have any idea that you'd landed on something that is going to become a 30-year-old multi-billion dollar franchise at this point?
Oh, my goodness, no. Actually, we were quite positive we wouldn't sell a single copy of the first issue. And thanks to my awesome uncle Quentin, who lived in Manchester, still does live in Manchester, New Hampshire. He loaned us $1,000 to print the first issue with no hope of actually getting repaid back for his investment. But we did something that was out of our love of comic books. We grew up as comic book kids, comic book geeks, and we loved the genre. And so we put all of our favorite things into this one comic book, and we wrote it for no one else but ourselves. Because, again, like I said, we didn't think we'd sell any copies, and we just had a blast doing it.
Now, I read, and I admit, I read this on Wikipedia, that the first TMNT comic book premiered at a comic convention at the Sheridan in Portsmouth. Really?
Totally, yeah. No, that was, we had a really great friend, still a great friend. I invited him to my wedding. I got married in Agunquit, Maine last year. And Ralph DiBernardo runs a comic book store in Rochester called Jetpack Comics. Still today, Pete and I did a signing there recently, but he used to hold these little comic book conventions in the Portsmouth Traffic Circle. And that was our target. It was a May 5th, 1984 convention. So Peter and I planned the completion of the work and the printing of the work to premiere specifically at that show. And invited all our family down, so it looked like we'd have a crowd around the table and all that. But yeah, those are our roots. You know, the Turtles were born in Dover, New Hampshire, and they premiered at a show in Portsmouth.
So funny. I mean, I don't ever really think of New Hampshire or Maine as a hub for comic artists. Was there much of a scene going on there at the time?
Well, you know, it was. If you were a comic book fan, you could find, you know, comic books on, one of those turnstiles at a local convenience store or, you know, and there was a very few comic book stores at that time, but there were a few around. But they would often, most of the gatherings for comic geeks would be at like flea markets and things like that where, you know, you'd have, you know, a booth here and there that would have lots of back issues. And so guys like me and Pete could go and look through, you know, different back issues to complete a collection of something we really loved or were interested in at the time. But I think the hub was mostly us, I guess.
The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles of today are pretty family-friendly action heroes. Those early comic books, however, were a bit darker than the Ninja Turtles that were eventually adapted for the big screen. What's the transformation about for you?
Oh, it was very specific. I mean, specific in the sense that when we did the first issue, the first bunch of issues, rather, we wrote them for ourselves. I mean, we really wrote the kind of things that we wanted to see in comics, what we loved about comics, and again, writing for a much older audience. When we started on the development for the cartoon show and the toy line, we knew that we were writing for a very specific younger audience. And so because we created, we owned and controlled all the rights and everything that was to be done with the Turtles, we worked on every aspect of the toy development, right down to, you know, Peter Laird's idea to make the bandanas different colors, you know, so you could tell them apart better. It was definitely a specific transition.
And color being a key word here because they were black and white originally.
That's exactly right, yes.
Well, tell us more about that first comic. You know, what did it look like exactly? Were the characters the same as the ones that we see in the films today? What was the sort of tone?
Well, what's so great about the new film was that the director, Jonathan Liebsman, when he started development on it, reached out to me directly, you know, right away and just said, look, I want to make a movie that pays respect to the original Turtles creation and, you know, basically 25 years, almost 30 years of history. I want it to be something that the fans will love, but I, you know, want to, you know, take advantage of the newest technology to make it a, you know, an up-to-date movie, if you will. But no, the heart and soul is all there. The comedy's there. The pizza's there. The edge is there, which was something that was the original comics were a bit more edgy than the cartoon series. But at the same time, you know, he wanted to keep some of the aspects of the cartoon series, like the pizza, and a lot more comedy than the original thing. But I think, yeah, the new movie absolutely, hands down, pays respect and is a true homage and a good representation of the original creation.
I'm imagining and ask you to imagine you and Peter, you know, these basement illustrators coming up with the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. Do you think that kind of off-the-map illustrator would stand a chance today in the digitally dominated comic world?
You know, I do in many respects, and the fact that what Peter and I were doing was not all that different from what early underground artists were doing in the late 60s, early 70s. to you know later you know different individual you know mini comics artists who were self publishing their work. That kind of time period in creative development. When I look at a specific one of my favorite sites is a site called DeviantArt, and DeviantArt is kind of like the Facebook for comic book artists and illustrators and writers, and you know people from all over the world get to post their latest work, their latest creation, be critiqued by other artists, and actually meet other artists and writers or collaborators, and you know try to get their ideas and the concepts refined and out there and exposed. And you know I think it's places like that that are kind of be where the next Ninja Turtle idea comes from. It's you know, the fans will let you know if they like it or not. That's always comes down to that.
Well, Kevin Eastman, all the best to you. Thanks so much for joining us.
A real pleasure. Thanks for having me today.
Kevin Eastman, co-creator of the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the multi-billion-dollar franchise that is now celebrating its 30th anniversary. You can read more about Kevin and his co-creator Peter Laird and the Turtles' New Hampshire origins, as well as see a link to DeviantArt, the site he mentioned. All that is at wordofmouthradio.org. There's more word of mouth coming right after the break. Please stay with us.
Word of mouth.
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 Word of
mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. At this year's Oscars, the film Gravity won for Best Sound Editing and Sound Mixing. While Gravity's subdued aural landscapes may give the impression of celestial silence, the universe is actually quite loud. From plasmic vibration to Earth proton whistlers, it seems the cosmos have a lot to say. Producer Todd Bookman brings us this story of deep space's newest noisemaker and what astronomers could learn from the signals.
All right, listen close, because it's only a fraction of a second long. That's real time. Let's play it again, slowed down. That is a fast radio burst, and the man who discovered it is Duncan Lorimer. He's a West Virginia University professor. Back in 2007, he and a graduate student were sifting through some data collected by a huge radio telescope in Australia, the Parkes Telescope, 210 feet wide, famously located in the middle of a sheep paddock. Anyways, they were looking at all the routine signals that come from our own galaxy when they came across this strange blip, this spike in the radio waves.
It had very different properties to what we were expecting. It appeared to be much, much further away. So we were completely flabbergasted. It was very surprising. We just didn't know what to make of it.
Neither did the scientific community. It was the first time anything like this had been captured. People started referring to it as the Lorimer burst.
Well, you know, it's a nice thing to have. It's not that important in the grand scheme of things, but it's a nice thing to tell your grandchildren about, I suppose.
Nice, yes, but without a second one on record, there were lots of doubts about what actually caused it. Maybe it was just some radio static or interference or a glitch in the software. 4 years went by, a very nerve-wracking 4 years for Lorimer, before anything similar to his burst appeared again in the sky. But then it happened. Parkes Telescope grabbed another one, and then, crucially, a different telescope, this one in Puerto Rico, spotted a burst. It was clear this wasn't a fluke. With only a few on record, though, it's tough to study them. Radio telescopes, despite their massive size, aim a fairly narrow beam at the sky. Some describe it as tunnel vision. And so it takes a while for a burst to pass through the sweet spot. Today, there's only about 10 on record, but scientists think there could be as many as 10,000 of them whizzing toward Earth every day, with some coming from very far away. At least, that's what their signal is suggesting.
And what we can see is that the waves arrive earliest at the telescope at the highest frequencies, and they sort of whistle across our telescope's range of frequencies. It's like a sort of a chirp.
The telescope, to be clear, doesn't actually hear a chirp. We've converted it into a wavelength that the human ear can detect. That scale, the high to low we hear, is caused by the different frequencies arriving at different times. They all start out together in space, but the lower frequencies get slowed down by the electrons they encounter on their long journey to Earth, sort of like hitting traffic. The time in between the highs and the lows, the short delay, allows astronomers to estimate the distance traveled. Lorimer says his burst may have gone 1 billion light years. 1 billion light years. I mean, it sounds like a Hollywood script.
2, 3, 5, 7. Those are all prime numbers, and there's no way that's a natural phenomenon.
Professor, do you know that movie from the late 90s with Jodie Foster?
Are you talking about Contact? Yeah, I know it.
What do you think of it?
Oh, I loved it. Yeah, it's a great movie. I used to work at the Arecibo Observatory where that was filmed, so it brings back a lot of memories every time I see it.
Who would you want to play you in the sequel?
I wouldn't mind a crack at it myself.
There may not be a Contact 2 on the horizon, but if you've seen the first, you may remember that the source of those radio transmissions is, well, it's aliens.
That is that has been discussed quite a bit. Because it's a single pulse, a single event, you could actually imagine an extraterrestrial civilization producing this either by accidentally or on purpose, you know, for instance, during one of their nuclear wars or something.
Alien nuclear war as the source? Well, probably not. Lorimer puts that pretty low on the list of possibilities. But at this point, nothing is ruled out. More likely origins are things like blitzars, which is a neutron star that, as it collapses into a black hole, sends out a flash of energy. Or it could be a flare sent off by a magnetar. They're spinning stars with a really strong magnetic field.
Something more exotic is the evaporation of a black hole formed in the early universe due to Hawking radiation that was very famously proposed by Stephen Hawking about 30 years ago. So that's, again, there would be an associated radio pulse with the final death throes of a black hole. The list goes on.
At this point, there are more theories than recorded bursts. While astronomers may not yet have a definitive source, they still see huge potential in what they could learn. Keith Bannister is a researcher based in Sydney, Australia, about 5 hours' drive from the telescope that has collected so many of these pulses. We connected over a fuzzy Skype line.
The organization I worked for was responsible for inventing Wi-Fi largely, and the Wi-Fi in our place is hopeless, so, you know, it doesn't win you much.
Bannister says that the data for each burst doesn't just provide an indication of how far it traveled, but also the road it took to get here.
When we detect one of these bursts, it carries with it a very distinctive signature that we can measure very accurately, and that signature, it tells you how much gas that the burst has gone through. They get that signature imprinted on them. Then if we find enough of them, we can actually essentially weigh how much gas there is in that part of the universe, which is a measurement that hasn't ever been possible before.
With that measurement, scientists could nail down what's in between galaxies. Or, Duncan Lorimer says, maybe learn more about the magnetic field of the universe. Really big picture stuff.
They're not going to solve any of mankind's problems right here on Earth. And you probably already knew that. But for astronomers, they're very interesting if we can figure out what they are and how far away they are.
Even with more radio telescopes looking for bursts, Lorimer says it may take 3 to 5 years to answer those questions. Unless the signal is coming from aliens, they may stop by even sooner. For Word of Mouth, I'm Todd Bookman.
Creating a fantasy universe with special effects is one thing. Doing it with a bunch of friends in your basement is a wholly different challenge. 40 years after its inception, the tabletop role-playing game Dungeons & Dragons is holding its own against online and electronic games played on a global scale. There's even a new version out. A glimpse of the new market for D&D when Word of Mouth continues after a short break. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The ultimate fantasy role-playing game, Dungeons & Dragons, turns 40 this year, and the makers of the game are banking on widespread excitement. D&D publisher Wizards of the Coast is in the process of launching a much-anticipated redesign 5th edition of the popular game and is targeting existing players and new fans alike. So if you've never played the game before, this could be your chance to see at last what it takes to become a dungeon master. David Ewald is contributing writer for Forbes and author of the book Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons and Dragons and the People Who Play It. The book is now out in paperback. And David, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
The last time Dungeons and Dragons released a new edition, that was the 4th, they did lose some market share and some diehard gamer core network, some of their diehard gamer core network. What do you think happened?
Well, what happened was that tabletop role-playing games like D&D had been dwindling in popularity from the 90s into the 2000s, and in large part because of the increasing popularity of video games. A lot of that audience of people who used to sit at a table and play games like D&D were now sitting in front of their TV or in front of their computer and playing games like World of Warcraft. So when the last version, the 4.0 edition of Dungeons & Dragons came out, the company tried to make it more video gamey. A lot of longtime players of the game complained that it felt like they were just mashing buttons on a controller. They were repeating the same actions over and over again. And the company sort of wanted that because they were trying to appeal to a new generation of gamers, but their core audience really got turned off by it.
So how about the new edition, the 5th? How is that different from previous versions?
Well, Wizards of the Coast tried to do a very ambitious redesign this time around. They realized that they've got 40 years worth of fans of Dungeons and Dragons, but part of their problem was, you know, a lot of those fans played the first edition. A lot of those fans played second and third and fourth, and the people who played the old versions weren't buying new product. So they decided they wanted to sort of unify the whole thing and make an edition that really spoke to the fundamentals of Dungeons and Dragons. They almost worried about the rules less than they focused on the setting and the feeling. They wanted everybody who sat down at the game to not be constrained by, okay, this is exactly how you poke somebody with your sword, and wanted the people to feel more like, okay, this feels like I'm on a fantasy adventure. Hmm. And that's really been their focus with the new edition.
So who's the market for the new edition?
Well, there is a core market of role-playing gamers. It's an aging audience. You know, it's a lot of people who started playing in the 80s and 90s. But Wizards of the Coast, which is owned by Hasbro, would like to see a much bigger market. They want this to be a toy and a game that the video game generation plays, that kids in their teens pick up and get into. So the market in that sense is very broad. You know, they really hope that for this to break out of its sort of very aging group of customers and become a phenomenon that, well, I play video games, so why not sit down at a table and play this other kind of game?
Now, they're doing a staggered launch for this. What does that mean?
Usually when a new edition of this game comes out, it's not like Monopoly. It's not just, okay, here's the box and the board and some dice. Because this game is, you know, played largely in your head and it's sort of, you know, it's an improvised adventure with your friends, it's all based on rule books. What they're doing this time around is, first, back in August, they released like the basic rules. It's basically like a 10-page pamphlet. They released it as an electronic book. And those basic rules are free. So people who have always been curious about the game and who have heard about it over the decades can just download those rules and they can get started without dropping a dime. Later that month, they released a box set they called the Starter Set, which is slightly more. It's $20, but it gets you, you know, through the first couple of levels of the game. You know, if you've tried it and you're into it, then you can say, all right, I'm willing to commit $20. If you want to be a long-term player, is where you get to where we are now. This month, the company released the Player's Handbook, which is the big $50 hardcover rule book that really gets you deep into the game. If you want to play it every week with your friends, if you want to have a campaign that goes for years, you're going to buy this Player's Handbook. And then there's the other two cool core rule books are called the Monster Manual and the Dungeon Master's Guide. And those are going to be staggered out over the next couple of months, probably to make spending $150 on three rule books a little bit more palatable.
But still, $150 compared to the price of some new electronic games is really nothing.
It is. I mean, you have to think about it that way. A video game comes out, new video games for the Xbox or the PlayStation cost $60, and you might play that video game for 2-3 weeks, put it away, and never play it again. The people who are really into games like Dungeons and Dragons might play this every single week for years and years. There's campaigns and groups that have played for decades. So yeah, that initial investment of $350 books isn't that much in the grand scheme of things. And thinking, you know, well, I'm going to get 6 hours of enjoyment out of this every single week.
Now, David, we really enjoy speaking to you. We really enjoyed your book on Dungeons and Dragons. But you said that they have to get over this aging hump. There's another hump I think they have to get over, the idea that people who play Dungeons and Dragons are kind of geeky, you know, the kind of guys that dress up as wizards and that kind of thing. Do you think they're going to get over that hump?
I think that is disappearing. I mean, it's always been a real problem that there's a stereotype of people who play this kind of game. And, you know, it exists because, you know, a lot of the times, you know, people who play this game are very geeky. But two things have happened. One is that gaming in general has gotten a lot broader and a lot more people are playing games. Everybody plays a video game now, whether it's on their phone or on their computer or on their tablet. Somebody's playing a game somewhere. So it's a little less of an intellectual leap to say, okay, yeah, I'm going to sit down at a table and play this game too. The other thing that's changing is that geeky is not a pejorative the same way it used to be. I mean, we are now living in a generation where the people who are sort of our cultural heroes are people like Mark Zuckerberg. You know, these are the computer nerds, the people who may have been made fun of 15, 20 years ago, but now they're the heroes of our society. And so being a geek is not a bad thing like it may have been 20 years ago. And that definitely helps people feel maybe less embarrassed about going to play a game like D&D.
Well, with the legacy, with all the competition from video games, do you think that the new Dungeons & Dragons can compete to become the mainstream role-playing game?
Yeah, I think Dungeons & Dragons is always going to be the number one role-playing game. It's got just such history and such a reputation behind it. You know, can it be as big as computerized role-playing games and as console role-playing games? That's tough because it requires a commitment. It requires you to round up some friends and you have to play it with people. So you have to get everyone together and play for a couple hours. You can't consume it in short bursts like you would something like World of Warcraft. So computer games, I think, are always probably going to be more popular. But D&D, I think, is in for a real revival. And the new 5th edition is already selling really, really well. And it shows that there's a real resurgence happening of this kind of gaming.
Well, David, great pleasure speaking with you. Thank you.
Thank you.
David Ewalt is contributing writer for Forbes. He's also author of the book Of Dice and Men, The Story of Dungeons and Dragons and the People Who Play It. The book is now out in paperback. We've got a link for you to listen to our interview with him when his book was first released. And you can also find a link to David's conversation with the brand director and executive producer of Dungeons and Dragons. He wrote it for Forbes. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Hey, Daniel. We're playing D&D tonight. You want to come?
Why?
I think you'd like it. We could show you how to play.
I couldn't do that.
Yeah, you would like it anyway. It's really boring.
No. No, it isn't, Neil. You love it. We sit around and crack jokes and eat junk food all night while we're fighting dragons and saving princesses and stuff. It's pretty fun.
And the best part is, you get to pretend to be somebody you can't be in real life.
Okay, I'll play.
Really?
Yeah, I'll play. Just don't expect me to be good at it or anything.
That's James Franco in the year 2000 playing Danny, the rebel without a cause, on Judd Apatow's TV series Freaks and Geeks. The celebration of D&D's 40th anniversary has inspired yet another project, the audiobook anthology of The Legend of Drizzt by R.A. Salvatore. Features a cast of characters who bring to life the tale of a dark elf. Some playing decidedly against type. Some of the celebrity voiceovers seem right at home with the subject matter. Here's Will Wheaton from Star Trek, The Next Generation.
Fill the buckets, grab a fish, muttered Ringo Heffenstone, a dwarf with exceptionally broad shoulders, even for a dwarf, and a large...
Rapper and actor Ice-T also lends his voice to the project and sounds, well, just a little less comfortable.
So he was alone. No, not alone. He corrected himself as he dropped a hand onto the crafted hilt of Kazatea, a sentient sword he had found beneath the devastated site where Obul...
To be fair, in the behind-the-scenes video for the recording, Ice-T admitted he was not familiar with the Dungeons & Dragons franchise.
For those people that don't know, there's some interesting words, so you have to learn the correct pronunciation. You know, this guy got a talking sword. It's interesting. It's definitely far from where I grew up.
If you didn't grow up with Dungeons & Dragons and are maybe a little nervous about it, actor Sean Astin shares your fears.
Right down to it, the multi-sided dice scared the hell out of me. I'm not kidding. There's 20 sides on one die? I know that's not right. That's not how, if you look at any other game, you don't see that.
Other celebrity narrators for the new audiobook include Al Yankovic, David Duchovny, Melissa Rauch, and Felicia Day. The 12-story anthology is available for free download at audible.com until September 20th. Dungeons & Dragons is an open-ended game. Depending on how often players meet, how many realms they'd like to explore, and how many campaigns they'd like to create, the game can last for hours, weeks, or even decades. For D&D lovers, rolling the 20-sided die is a way to spark creativity and connect with friends. The same holds true for gamers, like 13-year-old DJ Jones. But even though he and his friends bond over video games, his sister Sarah worries he spends too much time in the virtual world. And she brings us this story.
It's good.
On your feet!
Oh, crap, we gotta wait.
My brother could be described as a video game addict. DJ is 13 and spends all of his free time either on video games or the computer. He rushes through day-to-day routines like getting ready in the morning, doing homework, and eating dinner, just so he can get in some time on the electronics. I've noticed that DJ and his friends play video games as a sort of way to hang out. It's their form of Skype and texting. They goof off, and they have fun.
Awesome, mind you.
Oh, thanks.
Oh, yeah, no problem, I got him.
A little late, but yeah. Thanks for the
That's all it is to them, is fun. Around certain people in the real world, my brother is pretty shy. But when he enters the video game world, all of that goes away. There's a room in our house, and it has a few nicknames. There's the pool room and the man cave, so on. This room is filled with dusty electronics, a pool table, and plenty of seats. My brother and I have spent hour after hour in this room, playing a few different games. We yell and we scream, we get mad at each other and the game.
Dude, that's gonna be a good game. No, put it back. No.
But every time, we bond. I don't know what it means to him, but for me, it's just a really great way to spend time with my brother. DJ plays video games to just relax and have fun, and so do I. One friend of DJ's had another reason.
When I play sports games, like on NFL or football games, or basketball, I learn a lot of new stuff that I didn't know, like basketball tricks or trying to dunk the ball.
And though we get a lot of entertainment from the games, we also have things that could use more attention. If video games were gone from the world, I think that everyone would have the chance to work on those hobbies. Video games act as a sort of blindfold that blocks people from realizing those things that are truly important to them. I know that for my brother, it would be his raps. For his friend Peanut, he would have a different advantage.
Well, I'd have time for more sports, and I'd just be a lot better with my sports.
For myself, I don't get caught up in video games so much that I stop doing my art. I still find time to take photos and draw what I see in the world. When it comes to video games, I just enjoy sharing that common ground with my brother, which can be kind of hard to find. For Audio Revolution, this is Sarah Jones.
Thanks so much for spending some time with Word of Mouth today. Earlier in the show, we talked about precognitive policing. That's where law enforcement crunches data and studies social media and uses other predictive tactics to stop crimes before they happen. Think Minority Report. Researchers are now exploring the next steps, maybe brain scans that reveal propensity for unruly behavior or genetic testing for the aggressive warrior gene. Even if it were an effective means of stopping crime, does the idea of precognitive policing kind of creep you out? How would you feel about receiving a quick, imperceptible brain scan every time you walked by a government building, or being asked to take a genetic test when you apply for a job? Would you be willing just to help stop crime? Let us know on our Facebook page, facebook.com/wordofmouthradio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Please join us again for more conversations we came upon by word of mouth. We'll be back tomorrow at 2 on NHPR.
Word of Mouth is produced by
Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its board of trustees,
or its underwriters. Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio.